Well, my wife and I have done a lot of unique things in our 31 plus years of marriage, but I think one of the most unique things Pam and I have done in these 30 years is when we went riding in a hot air balloon. It was on our 20th anniversary. We had planned to go down to San Diego, California. It's a beautiful place to go, and we liked going down there. So we had reservations in a really nice hotel down there called the Hotel Del Coronado. It's a very famous hotel. But I wanted to add something else to the trip, you know, special. And so I began to check into taking a hot air balloon ride down there, because I know they do that, not just to the north of San Diego. And I was going to surprise her with it. But about a week before, I started thinking, I don't know if that's something you surprise your wife with or not, is a hot air balloon. Because it's going to cost me a lot of money to have the two of us reserve a place in this thing. And I don't want to get there and pull up and say, surprise. And she say, I'm not getting up in that thing, you know. So I did tell her about a week ahead of time. And fortunately, she was somewhat positive about it, believing that we could do this. So we did. We went there, and it was a large basket that was on the bottom of this balloon. It actually held about 8 to 10 people. So we were in a group of 8 to 10. And it was really a great experience. We went up, I think, to about 4,000 feet. We were above the cloud bank for a while. And it is just perfectly quiet up there, you know, when nobody's speaking or anything. It's just quiet. You can make it just kind of hang there, and we're just sitting there above the cloud looking at the cloud bank. It was peaceful. It was tranquil. And then we would start going back down through the cloud, and we'd enter back into the world again, so to speak, even to the point of sailing over some subdivisions and observing the people and admiring their landscaping and, you know, different things. People in the backyard would wave at us and say hello. And once again, seeing earthly life. It was really nice to be above the clouds for a while, but we did have to come back into the earth's view again. And when it came time to land, it was quite an earthly landing, actually. It was quite rough as we landed in a pasture. I couldn't help but think of that, though, as I was studying this week in our chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, believe it or not. Because much of the time that we have spent in this book, we have been engaged in seeing earthly life from strictly an earthly viewpoint. It's the journal of Solomon, as he was trying to, as we all know, find meaning and purpose in life, but seeing things only from an earthly viewpoint. But we've already seen this as well, that periodically Solomon, as it were, you know, rises above the clouds, so to speak, and he sort of gets above the clouds, and he interjects something that's more of a vertical perspective, not just an earthly horizontal perspective of life. It's a heavenly perspective. And that's exactly what we saw last time together in chapter 3, verses, the last two times, verses 12 to 15. This is one of those sections where we were definitely given a heavenly perspective in the midst of all of his cynicism, in the midst of all of his hopelessness that he was sharing with us that he had gone through during those years. It was a wonderful breath of fresh air, really, because those verses, 12 to 15 of Ecclesiastes 3, we're focusing on the joy that's possible in this life and focusing on something about God, a couple of facts about God. And we saw that in God's good and wise providence of all that goes on, we can experience joy because God is good. That was verses 12 and 13, and then verses 14 and 15. God is sovereign. And so that was a wonderful trip above the clouds there. But in verses 16 to 21, we're dropping back down below the clouds again. Okay, we're back down in the subdivisions. We're back down, you know, potentially landing hard in the pasture. We're once again seeing life under the sun. Once again, even experiencing the cynicism that developed in Solomon when he was not thinking rightly about things, when he was leaving God out of the picture. Now, in these verses, 16 to 21, there are a couple of spikes, though. I mean, there's just a couple of moments where he jets back up above the clouds and says something. But we definitely see his cynicism here as well. And the cause for his cynicism now that he's sharing is something that has basically always plagued mankind. It is the problem of injustice in the world. The fact that things are not fair. Now, we don't like the idea of injustice. We even get angry at injustice. We want truth to prevail. We want those who believe what is wrong and are doing what is wrong, we want them to lose in the end. Of course we do. We want those who treat others unfairly, we want them to get their just desserts, we say. I mean, we find ourselves hating the evil stepmother and the cruel stepsisters in Cinderella. I mean, they're bad. We don't want them to win. In fact, in life, we can't stand the idea of people like those stepsisters, you know, ending up with the glass slipper. It's just not fair. We want them stopped. We even want them to suffer. We want them to be punished. There are things in this world related to sadness, and that's something different. I think in some ways we can stand sadness better than injustice because sadness just makes us, well, sad. Okay. We know life's not going to be perfect. We know that there's disappointments in life. We know that there's sickness and things we have to go through. We know people are going to suffer. But injustice doesn't just make us sad. We get angry. We can get pretty angry. I mean, you see a video of Osama bin Laden, you know, laughing and rejoicing over how many Americans he's killed. It's just not fair, you know. We're angry. We can be pretty shocked at how angry we can get. And even lesser examples than that. I mean, there's other examples of injustice that we still get angry about. Someone cutting in line. Does that get to you? When I see somebody cutting in line, when I've been waiting in line a long time, I've seen that at theme parks, places like Disneyland, Knott's Berry Farm, places like that, long lines. And you see a couple of, you know, ungracious, untrained teenagers, you know, sort of work the system and cut in the line at the front. You want to go punch somebody like that. I mean, you want to even the score. I mean, it's not fair. Maybe kids experience it in school sometimes. Sometimes things go wrong and the wrong kid gets punished in school. Or some of those situations where the teacher punishes the entire class because of what somebody has done and they just can't figure out who did it, so punish everybody. Maybe it's the bully on the campus that harasses another student and no one ever seems to see it. Or maybe just no one ever does anything about it. I mean, there's all kinds of injustice in our world. And it's not hard to understand how somebody can transition from anger to cynicism. When there's injustice that's not resolved, it can easily go into a lifestyle of being cynical. And Solomon became very cynical over several issues in life, but now it's injustice. Now, it's understandable, even following up on what we studied in verses 12 to 15, it's an understandable follow-up thought to what we were rejoicing over in God. It's as if the text is asking now, well, how can you focus on God's goodness? How can you rejoice in the fact that God is good? How can you rejoice in the fact that God is sovereignly in control of everything and He's working out His perfect will? How can you do that when you look around you and you see injustice in the world? I mean, He's just gone above the clouds, given us this wonderful breath of fresh air and this look of God. And now He plummets back down below the clouds. Verse 16, furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice, there's wickedness. In the place of righteousness, there's wickedness. I mean, didn't he just write in verse 14, I know that everything God does will remain forever. Verse 12, I know that there's nothing better for them to rejoice and do good. Yeah, no, he's back below the clouds. And he's mentioning really a couple of problems. And this is the biggest one. So what I want to do is just kind of walk you through these verses and note the two problems that Solomon is bringing to the surface that's related to all this, but also the spike above the clouds where he does give two solutions to those problems. So problem number one in this passage is that one, the problem of injustice. Now, in verse 16, when he says, I have seen, that's actually a phrase that signals a turn. It's a way for him to signal a new paragraph here in his writing. But it's the idea of reflection. He's made some observations. He has seen something about the problems in life, and he's actually dwelling upon them. He's reflecting upon them. And in a sense, that reflection is transitioning to stewing over the problem. And evidently, he had seen literal examples of this. That's part of what he means by that terminology, I have seen. He evidently has specific instances in mind, something he's thinking about. But of course, the point he's making is far beyond what he himself has seen. He's seen these examples, but now he's reflecting over it. He's stewing over it and realizing that he's pointing out something that he knows to be true everywhere. It's true all over the world. All kinds of injustice in society. But of all the kinds of injustice, perhaps one of the ones that's the most disturbing is the thought of injustice in an arena that is designed for justice. And there's an allusion here to that in verse 16 when he says, in the place of justice. There's an allusion here to literally the place where justice is supposed to be meted out. The halls of justice. In other words, the courts. The courts. God instituted the idea of courts, the idea of human tribunals, you know, that render verdicts. He instituted this as a way, as a place for men to go, people to go, mankind, when I say men, for men to go for justice, to find judicial relief when things are not fair in life. And Solomon's observing that even there, in the very place where righteousness is supposed to appear, even there corruption is found. So if in the halls of justice, if literally the place that's been designed to mete out justice to people who need justice, if there's corruption there, then there's corruption everywhere. There's all kinds of unfairness. We know this to be true in our courts. There's injustice and unfairness and among lawyers, legal games that they're expected to play. I've seen it myself, and I've experienced it myself. There's injustice among judges. There's accounts of judges throughout history who accept bribes, who show favoritism. I know one personally. He lost his position over that. Examples of prejudice in rendering out verdicts, greed. I mean, in the peripheral world of the courts, if you just throw in also the idea of the ones who are supposed to protect us, the police, are there examples of injustice and corruption there? Sure there are. Even those who commit crimes. We know this is part of our world. And when you start talking about crime being committed there or injustice in a court system, that's pretty serious. I mean, for the court to wrong an innocent party and end up clearing the guilty, I mean, that's pretty dangerous business, and God hates it. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 19 real quick. 2 Chronicles 19. If you're having trouble finding it, it's right after 1 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles, chapter 19, verse 6. This is Jehoshaphat. And he is warning the judges of his day. Let's look at verse 6 and maybe 7 as well. And he said to the judges, consider what you are doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord. I mean, the agents of the court systems, you know, they are representing God. God set up these as places to find justice to represent him on earth. You do not judge for man, but for the Lord who is with you when you render judgment. Now then, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. I think these verses need to be kind of tacked up, you know, in courtrooms all across our world. Let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Be careful what you do, for the Lord our God will have no part in unrighteousness or partiality or in the taking of a bribe. God hates this kind of injustice, this kind of dishonesty. But the truth is, if we're going to be honest, we realize it's going on all the time. And it's very disturbing. And we despise the thought that a problem like this does exist in our world. He despised it. Solomon did. But then he moves from the problem and he pops above the clouds in his hot air balloon and he gives solution. So problem number one is the problem of injustice. Solution number one is this. God will bring the appropriate justice someday in the future. See, that's the solution. Verse 17. I said to myself, it's okay to talk to yourself, by the way. There's examples of it in the Bible. Don't get too carried away with it. People will wonder. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. For a time for every matter and for every deed is there. His point is, and again, he's popping up above the clouds and giving us the vertical perspective again. The point is that injustice is real, but it's also temporary, see? It's temporary. He's not riding under the sun when he says this. He's not riding horizontally in verse 17. So the point is, wrong is there, but wrong will not last forever. Wrong is going to be judged under the sovereign hand of a just God who's perfectly just. Injustice has a reign right now in our world, but it's a temporary reign. And so the application to our lives is we can't get bent out of shape about that. We recognize it to be true and we hate it. But at the same time, because we know this to be true, that what we experience in this life is temporary and the injustice then is therefore temporary, we can rest easy knowing that every wrong will be righted someday by the ultimate judge. Now, you need to know this term judged in Hebrew. God will judge. It's a word that means more than just some sort of judicial assessment that he makes, that he looks at it and says, yeah, you know, that's wrong. I officially declare that it's wrong. No, it's a word that includes the execution of a sentence also. The judge makes the assessment that it's wrong and he renders the sentence and he executes it. He'll make things right. Depending on your translation, verse 17 ends with the word there. God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. There's been a lot of uncertainty about this term, and there is a degree of lack of clarity in what this term means. It's a simple term. But, you know, there's been some challenge trying to figure out what exactly the there is referring to. A time for every matter and for every deed is there. Some have said that it could mean it's in reference to the events of the injustice. In other words, even though there's injustice going on, in the midst of the injustice and the injustice and unjust acts of man, God is judicially at work. But the context really, really necessitates that we consider that word there is connected to the future idea as well. God's going to judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time for judgment. In other words, judgment on every matter and every deed is there in that designated time of judgment someday. It's talking about the consummation of his judgment. He may be and certainly is active now. And there are little tastes of his judgment here and there. And there's no telling what he may be doing that we don't know about in rendering out some sort of justice in this world. He is active. But here it's eschatological. Here it really is future. It's the there at the end of time. At that time that God has designated, that place and that time, there is judgment. He's storing it up to pour it out on injustice. Now, Solomon doesn't elaborate on exactly what awaits him. His point is not to be that detailed. And in a sense, he doesn't know. He's not saying he knows exactly what God's going to do, and that doesn't matter. He just knows that a day of reckoning is set, a day of reckoning is coming, and he learned how to take some solace in that. That was the solution eventually to the problem in his own heart, the problem of injustice. And unfortunately, you know, Solomon doesn't stop there. He keeps going, and now he becomes cynical again. He's sharing his cynicism. You know, he's back below the clouds again. And he gives the second problem. Here's problem number two. And these are connected, but problem number two is this. Men have no advantage over animals because both are mortal. Okay. Men have no advantage over animals, the beasts, because both are mortal. You read 18 through 20. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place, all came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Now, this is still connected with his being disturbed over injustice. It's like one leads to the other. You know, when he realized that there's supposed to be justice, but there's not justice in the world, he begins to take another step back and says, you know, ultimately, we're no better off than beasts are. No better off. And so he's very cynical here. And if you focus your attention on corruption, if you focus on unfairness long enough in your life, you will come potentially to some very heretical conclusions, as Solomon had. Now, before I sort of summarize that little passage, I want to comment just a few things about the verses themselves, just a little bit of the data there. For example, in verse 18, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them. That word means to make something clear. God has gone about doing something to make it clear. God has surely not just tested them, but he's brought about some sort of testing. He's brought about circumstances that's making it clear to them. If man will look at it, it's clear to him that he is just a beast. And if something is clear, is even past that, it's the meaning that what's clear is not that they're just beasts, but what's clear is they by themselves, without God's help, are just beasts. God has surely tested them, made it clear to them, in order for them to see that they, and that little pronoun they is constructed to be emphasized, so that they, meaning they by themselves, will see that they're just animals. Now, we do know from Genesis that there are some similarities between the creation of man, the creation of animals. There's actually more similarities than some maybe have even thought of. In a sense, they share a common origin. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, in Genesis chapter 2, then verse 19, you find both were formed out of the ground, out of the dust of the ground. Both have this principle of life in them called the breath of life. And because of that, they're both called living beings. It's translated just a little bit differently in chapter 1, verses 21 and 24 about the animals, but it's the same Hebrew word. It says man became a living soul. In chapter 1, it says the animals were living souls, living beings. In other words, there is a principle of life in an animal. An animal is alive. Man's alive. Actually, both were told to go forth and multiply. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. In Genesis chapter 1, the animals were told and blessed. Multiply, replenish the earth. Later on, man's told, multiply, you know, replenish the earth. There are some similarities. And what this is saying is God has so worked and so brought about things that if man will honestly look at himself, God has made it clear by the way he allows them to live, that they will see that by themselves, without him, it's just the similarities is all that they experience. They have life, like so is an animal. They're living beings, so is an animal. Formed out of the dust of the ground, so is an animal. Both given the charge to multiply, so are the animals, see? Man and animals. I'll come back to this in a moment. That's just some data about that word tested, about the word the. Verse 19. This verse is emphasizing, again, what's similar between men and animals. He says, for the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. The word fate there is talking about death, the end. He's not talking about life after death. Don't read that into anything here. He's talking about not life after death, heaven and hell, all that applies to both. He's just talking about one thing, death, when he says fate. Their fate is the same. Death is the great leveler. It's the great leveler between people, whether you're rich or poor. Death's the same. But also death is a leveler between men and animals. Both die. Both return to the earth. That's true. And both die when that principle of life that made them a living soul ends. If that principle of life ends, they're dead. A dog's dead. A man's dead. So Solomon is just recognizing all that and saying, if you just stop there, in a sense, there is no advantage of a man over a beast. There can be injustice in the animal world. There can be injustice in the human world. In a sense, humans don't live any differently than animals do. There's no advantage of being a man over a beast. The end result is the same. Verse 20, a little data there. All go to the same place. Don't read anything into more to this than what Solomon intended. This is not all dogs go to heaven. It's not anything like that. They all go to the same place, meaning that Old Testament concept of Sheol. Sheol is just the realm of the dead. He's not distinguishing compartments, good and bad, hell and heaven and hell and paradise and the bosom of Abraham or any of those kind of concepts that we do know exist in Scripture. He's just talking about they go to the same place. They go to the realm of the dead. Sheol. All came from the dust and all return to the dust. And that's a problem to Solomon. It's feeding his cynicism along with this injustice. That the world is supposed to be a better place for humans, but even in the courts of justice there's corruption. So you can't find justice. In fact, we end up living just like animals do. So what's the solution? Well, he gives one. That was problem number two. There really seems to be no advantage for a man over an animal. Both die. But here's the solution number two. And we'll see it. God uses the injustice in our lives. And there ends up being one thing very different between us and animals. God uses injustice in our lives. And there ends up being something very different between us and animals. Back to verse 18 then. As I've already told you and stressed the data to you, the word tested means to make clear. God has made it clear that they by themselves are beast-like. Man can do very unfair, unloving, corrupt things. He's beast-like. And living in an unjust world without God, that's what happens. Man becomes beast-like in his action. He becomes beast-like in his reactions to things. Why is God making it clear, testing them and making it clear? So that man would come to see his desperate need for help outside himself. That he needs help from above the clouds, above the sun. Horizontally, they're beast-like. Apart from that help, our depravity knows no bounds what we'll do to one another. People do terrible things to one another. So Solomon is saying that since the fate of men is the same as the fate of beasts as far as being mortal goes, we shouldn't really be surprised that we take injustice to the very farthest extreme sometime. We shouldn't be shocked at the injustice in the world. I mean, after all, if people really do live with the mindset that they're just higher evolved animals, and if they really do live with the mindset that when the end comes, it's the same as animals, it's no different, then becoming unjust while you're alive for the sake of personal gain so you get something out of all this, it makes a lot of sense then. It makes sense to be beast-like. You got to fight for number one. You got to protect yourself. You've got to do things out of selfish motivations. You've got to be beast-like. Of course it's going to be that way with people. So there's a sense in which God allows this to continue, verse 18. He's making it clear. He allows it to continue because he's using the injustice to reveal what we really are like without him and the depths that people will go to in their depravity if we're only living horizontally. Yes, they're similar. This one similarity is true. They come from the dust and they return to the dust. And God uses this one similarity to show men their frailty, to show men that they must turn back and search for Him. Verse 21. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? The attitude of lost man is that since there's no ultimate difference between men and animals, then they can live any way they want. But you need to know something about verse 21. Your translation may very well have it as a question, just like this translation that I read from does. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? The very best grammatical evidence. And I can tell you, I read a lot on this verse. Everyone's in agreement. It's not a question. It really is not a question. The grammar dictates that it needs to be written as a statement. Here's what it says. It's a statement. The breath of man is that which ascends upward. And the breath of the beast is that which descends downward to the earth. Solomon is not questioning something here. Solomon is pointing out what is the truth about man and animals beyond this similarity that they both came from the ground. There's something that lost man is not incorporating into his thinking. The truth about the difference between man and animals. And the difference he illuminates here is the difference between man and beast in what follows death. Yes, they both die when the principle of life leaves them. And they don't look any different. Neither one's moving. Each gets rigor mortis. But there's a huge difference in what happens to men and animals from death onward. Totally different. And because it's true that the breath of man ascends upward, and we'll talk about that in a moment, the living principle of man. It lives on. And because it's true that the breath of the beast, the living principle of the beast, descends into the earth, meaning it's over. Because that's true, we cannot live as if there really is no difference between the two. We have to live with the understanding that there is a huge difference. Now you can study Psalm 49 sometime. It's similar to what's being said in Psalm 49. The first 12 verses of Psalm 49 actually also make a point that man and beast are alike. In the second half of the Psalm, 13 through 20, it references their distinct destinies, though, after the grave. You put a dead dog in the ground, a hole in the ground. You put a dead person in a hole in the ground. All looks the same. No. Big difference. The life principle of man, the breath of man, ascends upward. Just a note about death. Tragically, we seldom take to heart as we ought to the reality of death and all that the Bible says about death. I think in our world, we tend to be insulated from it in a large degree. And I mean compared to their world. They didn't have all that we have today that occupies our minds. You know, all the electronic gadgetry and everything else that we can escape into and occupy us. And I mean, we have hospitals that take people who are really sick away from our presence. You know, we have rest homes, etc. There's a sense in which the general populace is really removed from the sound and the sight of death. It wasn't like that in their culture. Death was all around them. It was ever before them. And most of them seemed to ignore the difference then between men and animals, concluding they were both ending up the same way. But something's different. So in Ecclesiastes 3 here, how life after death is conceived is not given in detail. He doesn't go into great detail talking about it, but we're just told that it's different. And this phrase upwards is the idea that the human life, the life principle of man, our soul, subsequent to death, ascending upwards means that person is dealt with by God now. Okay. He's dealt with by God. Ascending downward to the earth, it's over. Man, the breath of life ascends upward. He's going to face his Creator. It's not over. He's not getting into details of what does God do at that point. You know, we have certainly a lot of teaching in the judgment seat of Christ, the great white throne judgment, what happens to believers, what happens to unbelievers. He's not getting into that detail. He's just painting the broad stroke, the concept that human life or breath differs from animals in this great sense. Now, we understand, certainly, even in this life, we're different from animals. We understand that the life principle within us is so totally different than animals. We're made in the image of God. God's imprint is upon us. That's not true of them. And because of that, we find in Scripture that our life principle, you know, the breath in us, it's associated with thought and moral reasoning and understanding and inner courage and intelligence and reflections and emotional states and the pondering of God and the worship of God. Yes, that's all true of us. It distinguishes us from animals even here. He's just not talking about all that here in this passage. He's just emphasizing, what about after this world's over? What about after the world of injustice has ended? There's a big difference. And so the solution is, we're not the same. We're not the same at all. There's a great advantage. We get to his conclusion now in verse 22. And I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? I mentioned to you more than once along the way that a lot of the language in this verse is difficult, very difficult to translate. But let me see if I can capture for us tonight what Solomon's conclusion is in all this. He definitely doesn't say this. The conclusion when all is said and done is, since there's injustice in the world, because men and animals are basically the same and they act beast-like, and why not? Since all that's true, you know, he doesn't say the best solution to all that is just you need to retaliate. If some unfairness happens to you, what you need to do is take it in your own hands and retaliate. He doesn't say become resentful. He doesn't say to get bitter. He doesn't say you just really need to focus every day on how life has been unfair for you, how you have not been given a fair shake. He doesn't say to escape. You know, move to some spot out there in the woods, some lonely spot, and just whatever remaining years you have, just grind them away in silence, resenting, you know, this world that you've escaped from that was unfair. He doesn't say, no, stay in the world, work in the world, but escape mentally. Find a way to work in the world, but live in a make-believe world somehow. No, in essence, he says, reject all the self-pity. Reject revenge. Reject resentment. Reject retaliation. In fact, find ways. I'm really giving you the extrapolation, the application of this verse. Find ways to discover what the advantages are. What's the good points about even your disadvantages that you've suffered in this world? Whatever element of injustice you have experienced, whatever unfairness that you've had to deal with, whatever moments of disadvantage in this world you've experienced, twist it around, discover the advantage. He says, I've seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. Now, if God is sovereign in his oversight of all the earthly events, verses 1 to 15 of this chapter, he's sovereign over everything. If verse 21, he holds our ultimate destinies in his hand, you know, we're going to face him, verse 21. He's the judge. He's got the verdict. He holds our destiny eternally in his hands. Then the attitude of the wise person should be joyful confidence in him that results in pursuing all your responsibilities with joy, enjoying the pleasures that they bring, regardless of your lot in life. Notice how he uses that term. There's nothing better than that man should be happy in his activities, pursuing his responsibilities with zeal and with courage and with confidence and enjoying them, happy in them. There's pleasure to be found in them. Find that pleasure and enjoy it. Nothing better than that, for that's his lot. We use that term sometimes. We say, this is my lot in life. We normally just use it in a negative sense. But the idea here in this word is that it's not just negative. It carries a lot of good things. It can be translated even portion. You know, this is your portion. This is what God wants you to have. Your lot in life is going to include all kinds of experiences. And God intends you to enjoy the earthly blessings that are part of that lot, the work, the food, the drink, the wealth, possessions, the family joys, all that. And how you live your life in the lot that God in His providence has deemed necessary for you to experience, how you live your life is important, not just for your own happiness, but also for how it's going to impact others. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? A very interesting phrase, what will occur after him. And this is not talking about the judgment, the future judgment. This is not talking about some eschatological sort of judgment that's out there. This is talking about what is the result of your life here in this world. That since God is going to right every wrong, and you're convinced of that, and since you know you're not an animal, you're far different than that. Not only in this world, but definitely it'll become out in the life to come. It'll become very apparent that you're different. Live your life out of that, regardless of what your lot is. Whatever lot God has given you, all the experiences that go with it, live it in joy. Be happy in your activities. But not only for your own happiness. There's going to be the one that comes and see what will occur after you. What does that mean? Earthly events continue to happen after we die that we have no living part in if we're dead. But yet we do have a part in them in how we live now, because how we live now can have continuing effects in the lives of others that do come after us. When it says what will occur after him, and seeing what will occur after you, make it personal, that's talking about coming to grips with the reality that you don't just live for yourself. There are continuing effects in the lives of others because of the choices you make today and the impact you have on people today. If you are the wise person who's living in the solutions that are given in this passage and not the problems, if you're happy in all your activities and the lot that God has given you. So I want to talk about that as we conclude here for a moment. When it comes to your lot in life, even if it includes injustice, and it probably has, either in the past, or you're in some unfair situation right now, or you've got one coming that you don't know about. In your lot, we can basically do little to change that lot now. And our lot includes the disadvantages, the injustices. It includes the trials. It includes the unfairness, the mistreatment, the suffering. It includes all that. And it includes advantages, blessings, times of refreshing, times of justice. Our lives include all of this. And the point is, by Solomon, if something is in the disadvantage category, the injustice category, there's no promise that that's going to change in this world. No promise. In the future? Yes. Not now. And since we can't change our lot in most cases, what we need to be concerned about changing is our reactions to our lot. Okay? Our response to what God in His providence has allowed to happen in our lives. What the makeup of your lot is. Now, I certainly deal with this in my own life. I help people deal with it in their lives. It's common in, pastoral ministry. People want their situation to change. People want their lot to be different than it is. And perhaps I can help it change. Perhaps I can fix their boss who's unfair. Or I can fix their spouse so they'll be happy. But the situation or the spouse or the boss or whatever it is many times does not change. It just doesn't. He or she doesn't. And for many people, that change of having to have their lot different, for injustice to be taken care of, and for fairness to reign, and for me to get what is fair and to be treated well, for me to have a sense of fairness there, that change in having a lot like that ends up becoming an idol for people. But though we can't necessarily help someone's circumstances change, we can help someone change their reaction to their lot in life, to their circumstances. There's a related thought here about a person's past. A person can be struggling over injustice in the past. Things were not fair when they were a child, school, previous jobs, whatever it may be. Could be 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 1 year ago, it doesn't matter. The past. And the reality of it is, we can't change that either. Solomon, nowhere in this verse, is talking about changing the lot. He's talking about being happy in it, but the happiness does not depend on changing it. That's what the word lot means. In God's providence, this is yours. I can't change many things about the present circumstances. I certainly can't change anything about the past. The past is unchangeable. It can never, ever be altered. No matter how smart we are, our past is like something that stands in concrete and hardened, and it will not be altered. You cannot erase it. But we can learn to see our past from God's perspective. Even the bad things that have happened, even the injustice, even the advantages of what's happened in the past, we can respond in such a way that we see them from God's perspective and end up using the disadvantages to advantage. And that happens by our response to them. We can respond to both the past and current disadvantages in such a way that we're seizing them, as it were, and using them for God's glory. Hold your place there for a moment and turn to Genesis chapter 49. I'll show you a real good example of this. And we'll try to wrap all this up. Genesis 49. Maybe something earlier. Find it in a moment. Well, I'm looking for the passage, maybe you can find it, where he names his son Manasseh. I think I'm about several chapters too far ahead. Here we go. Genesis 41. Genesis 41, verses 50 and 51. And 52. Now, before the year of famine came, Genesis 41, verse 50, before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Now, keep in mind all that had happened to Joseph in his past. Do you know anything about that story? Was there any injustice there? Okay. Any unfairness? Any mistreatment? His lot, was it fair? Was it all good? No, we know the story of Joseph. This is in the annals of time now for us to look at and get some encouragement from. Two sons were born to Joseph. And if you're looking for, planning to have more children, looking for names, here's some names here for you to consider. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. We don't really connect with biblical names. And Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh. Why? Because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. What does Manasseh mean? Manasseh literally means one who causes to forget. That's what he named his son. Hey, come here, one who causes to forget. That's his son's name. I mean, it doesn't fit with our English mindset. Manasseh. But here's the interesting thing. He's naming him Manasseh in reference to what his brothers did to him that was wrong. And he's naming him that because God made me forget what they did. Well, if he really forgot what they did, then why is he naming the son something related to what the brothers did? See? What does it mean here? It doesn't mean that literally he has forgotten something that happened to him. He has no cognitive recognition of it. Believe me, Joseph was going to remember those events as long as he lived, being sold into bondage unfairly, being put into prison because of Potiphar's wife unfairly, being forgotten in prison once he was promised that someone was getting him out. He was forgotten there, left there. He understands what injustice looks like. He understands what beast-like activity looks like. When people are only living horizontally and they're not thinking about the fact that they're not an animal, they're going to stand before God someday. Their inner, the soul of man is going to ascend upwards and God's going to deal with them. His brothers were acting beast-like. Then what does it mean that he's made me forget all my trouble? Basically, it's this. God has removed the burden of the memory of his past. It's no longer a burden. Because by this time, God has done marvelous work in Joseph's life. So that what was happening was being run through the grid of what God was doing. And so you see even another expression there in verse 52. And he named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. There you're talking about an example of a lot that's full of disadvantages. And he turns them all into advantages, really lives out verse 22 of our text of Ecclesiastes 3. Nothing was better for Joseph than to be happy in his activities because this was his lot in life. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Listen, the choices that Joseph made, and I'm not saying you're going to end up being written down in the annals of time for generations, thousands of years to read your story. But Joseph is an extreme example of this, of what would occur after him. How in Genesis 50, God overturned all the evil and used it for good. And how we are now, these centuries and centuries and centuries later, reading the story of Joseph and getting benefit from his life. I won't say that it'll be like that for you in every case, but let me just ask you this. Do you have family members? Do you have children? Do you have people that you work with? I mean, do you have people that you interact with in your world? Okay, if you're not a loner, I mean, you've got some people. Your disadvantages, your suffering, your lot in life is not just for you. God's not just using it to shape you. He's using your lot in life to shape other people and affect them as well. You have to be thinking, what occurs after me? I make an impact on other people. And who knows the impact your life can have on others when you don't live in cynicism, and you seize the disadvantages and you turn them into advantages because you have a positive attitude of response even to injustice and unfairness. We've got enough people in the world who live in self-pity because of injustice. We've got plenty. We don't need any more. We got plenty of people who live in the cesspool of discontent in life because life's not fair. All they can tell you is how wrong something was and how wrong it is now, or how unfair a person was or is being now, or how someone broke their promise, or this person walked away from me and just left me with me and the kids, This person just broke up our business and took me to the cleaners financially. And they live in what happened the rest of their lives. But the application of Solomon's words are in effect this. In effect, here's what he's saying, to make it applicable. I suggest to you, he says, that there's nothing better than that you look for an advantage and seize it and use it. Be happy in it. Use it for good. Make your life a blessing because of the responses that you have to your lots, the things of your lot. And make it your life message because you have no idea how you're going to be impacting somebody else that comes after you because of the choices you make today. So when you make it personal, you say, what is my disadvantage then? What's unjust in my past, in my present? What's a major unjust disadvantage in your life? And then ask yourself the question, am I going to replace any kind of temptations of self-pity? Am I going to replace it with something active, not just passive self-pity, but actively seizing it, courageously seizing it, and turning it into good? You know, it's stopping the woe is me sort of attitude and thinking in terms of, world, here's the message of my life. Here's my life. And whatever your lot has been in life, whatever injustices, you know, it ends up being the package of stuff that makes you unique. Each one of us are different in that regard. It's what makes you distinct and different. And people need to see that. They don't need to see someone else that's like them. They need to see some distinctness, how you're responding to life's injustices. So have you ever considered that? The impact your message can have on the world around you. Well, if you can ever get above the clouds, see, and you get above the disadvantage long enough to see how God can use it to impact the lives of others who are victims of their own disadvantages, then you'll be changed forever. Your story of your life has impact. You do have a story. See, each person tonight has a story. We all do. Everybody has a story. And that story has injustices in it. But it's just not what ultimately is what important. If it becomes what's important, then you become cynical. I mean, angry and then cynical. And you live in cynicism. So Solomon is so gracious on the Lord's inspiration to keep spiking above the clouds, you know, to say that no, injustice is not what makes somebody a failure. Injustice is not what disqualifies a person, you know. No, it's just your lot in life. In God's providence, and you end up being significantly used by God if you don't allow those things to turn you into a cynic, like it almost did eternally for Solomon. But he rose above the clouds. Let's pray.